This is the SF Signal Podcast. I'm your host most of the time. My name is Patrick Hester. I am an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And tonight, it's that time when I decide that torturing the SF Signal irregulars is not enough for me, and I have to bring Jame on and torture her. Hi, Jame.
Hello. I am Jame Gates. I'm an editor, author, and the communications director for the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. One of my earliest forays into science fiction and fantasy was Star Trek. So, you know, we've all made some poor decisions, but that one keeps making worse decisions.
And shut the front door.
In other news, I may have started trying to watch Forward into Darkness or whatever that newest abomination is today. So.
Oh, the new movies? Yeah, the new movies you got to take with a... That's JJ Trek. You got to take that with a grain of salt.
No, you have to take that with a whole salt mine.
Well, you have to take it with a grain of salt and a shot of Jaeger, so...
Ew. Oh, I hate Jaeger so much.
Exactly, yeah. But if you're willing to drink it, then you can watch the movie. But hey, you know what? My thing about that movie is that it's not what people thought it was. It's not a remake of Wrath of Khan. It's a remake of Space Seed and a really bad one. But it's okay.
Yeah. It's no, okay. It's not.
Because you know what? He's moved on. Now he's going to do Star Wars. Nothing bad can happen there. So, Jame has assembled a bunch of really smart people to talk about our topic tonight. Jame, do you want to tell people what the topic is before I introduce people?
So, we're going to be talking about space opera today, and I feel like that term maybe gets a little bit of grief. It's, you know, the definition of space opera is big, sprawling civilizations, great battles in the stars, and unfortunately it all too often also gets called the cheesy, low-rent cousin of hard science fiction and stuff like that. So this is about why it is actually one of the very valuable subgenres of science fiction and the influence that it has had on culture and other media.
And you've assembled a bunch of people to talk about this. Because I don't like to butcher people's names, except for James, I will actually just say your first name. And then if you could tell people who you are and what you do, that'd be awesome. Let's start with Jason.
My name is Jason Bont, and I am the creative and editorial manager for the 100-Year Starship. And 100-Year Starship is an organization led by former astronaut Dr. Mae Jemison, and our intent is to develop the capacity for interstellar travel in the next 100 years. I'm also a writer. I've got a story coming out in Bastion Science Fiction Magazine in August, and I've also got a children's series, The Tales of Dreamside.
That's very cool. I recently had lunch with the lead engineer on the Nevada Space Plane Project.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's an organization that's also making it happen, too.
Yes. And if for folks who don't know, I'm talking about Karen Burnham, who is a longtime contributor to SF Signal. She has been a longtime part of Locus, and she recently moved to Colorado to be part of that project, which is just awesome. And I'm hoping that, you know, by getting in on the ground floor, she can get me to space, damn it. Next up, I'm going to say hello to Daniel.
Hey, folks. My name's Daniel Abraham, and I write novels and short stories and occasionally comic books and such. The project that's kind of most germane to what we're talking about here is I'm half of James S. A. Corey, who writes the Expanse series.
Really?
Yeah. where was I going to go with that? Yes,
I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't
that's
know.
Yeah.
If you
were setting me up for something there, I didn't land it. I'm sorry.
So do you want to continue our conversation about Star Wars?
Well, I wrote a Star Wars book not long ago. So we wrote the last Star Wars book in the extended universe. Turns out we didn't know that when they started us off, but. As I understand, the next one coming out from Kevin Hearn is going to be the first one in the new canon.
Authorized.
And so ours was we closed the door. We got into the extended universe, expanded universe, and turned out the lights when we left.
And if you missed it, if you go over to the Functional Nerds podcast, Daniel and Ty do rip me a new one for not liking what's going on with the extended universe. But hey, that's okay.
Your idea about canonicity is very strange to me.
Next up is Tansy.
Hello.
Hi.
My name is Tansy Rainer Roberts. I'm from Tasmania, Australia. And I co-host a couple of podcasts, Galactic Suburbia and Verity, which are both very science fiction themed. I'm mostly known as a fantasy novelist, but right now I am working on my first space opera as a web serial published weekly on my blog. And it's called Musketeer Space. It is a gender-swapped space opera retelling of The Three Musketeers. So I'm very immersed in thinking about space opera and how it works right now and how to make an 18th century novel set in the 17th century actually work as a space opera.
Very cool.
It turns out it requires a lot of heavy lifting in the world building. And that's me.
Very cool. And is there a Hugo Award nomination out there?
I actually have two nominations this year, one each for Galactic Suburbia and Verity. So either way, I'm getting my ticket to the Hugo Losers Party, unless there is, you know, a tie, which frankly is probably the most diplomatic, from my point of view, is the most diplomatic possible outcome.
What do you do in that situation?
I don't know. I have not attended a Hugo ceremony where I've been a nominee in the past, so this will be my first time.
You are in for a treat.
And there'll be at least one other representative of each of my podcasts in the audience. So I think I will just make sure that I don't know.
That is awesome. So congratulations.
Whatever happens, I might just end up hiding under my chair.
That's well, here's the plan. Here's what happens. So if they do call your name, right, mm-hmm. and you stand up, brace yourself. Because the next exact moment, Christopher Garcia hugs you. And it is an epic hug. It's an epic hug. Okay,
is this so just specific be prepared. To all Hugo Awards?
Yes. Have you ever seen one? I mean, it's like they call a name and Chris
I've
jumps
the ceremony.
Up.
Yes. I actually won one last year, but it was long distance.
Oh, and Chris jumps so, up. Yes, and he runs yeah. and he
so it would have been my
you.
Friend Deb Stanish who got the hug.
Yes. Yes, it's awesome.
Doesn't really translate over Skype.
Well, I wish I could be there with you to congratulate you.
Thank you. That's probably quite yes. I'm trying to think of the word, which means that is way too soon to be saying things like that. But yeah, it's going to be fun anyway. I'm very excited to be going to London.
Yes, it's awesome. Next up, let's say hello to Derek.
Hi, I'm a writer. I write science fiction, fantasy, and horror, but most of my science fiction is quite hard, and I was just saying on my website yesterday that I sold my fifth story to Asimov's just recently. It's the first one that has any humans in it. That's the kind of science fiction I write.
Very cool. And last but certainly not least, Stephen.
Hey there, I'm Stephen Hood. I'm co-founder of Storium, the online storytelling game. We recently completed a large Kickstarter campaign, and we're in beta now. Storium basically turned writing into a multiplayer game.
It sounds very familiar. It's almost like I talked to someone about that on another podcast not too long ago.
It's almost like we've talked about this before.
Isn't it? Is it strange?
I will also note that I am the token non-writer on the panel.
Gotcha. Okay. And Storium has just exploded, right?
Not in a damaging way, fortunately. Right. It's growing pretty quickly, and we had a great Kickstarter campaign, raised over $250,000 when we were trying to raise $25,000. So that was very encouraging. There's been a lot of really positive response to it, so we're really excited.
And what was like the highest level that you unlocked?
We unlocked. We had a goal at the very end. We threw in for $250,000 to bring a much beloved world from the tabletop gaming world, the world of Champions, to basically four color comic book stories to Storium, and we were able to unlock that, which is pretty exciting because it's one of the games I played as a kid growing up, and it's sort of closing the circle for me.
Was there ever an offer to have like Rigora Mortis's his world as part of the Storium thing?
Patrick?
we ended up with a big list of people. We didn't get everyone that we would have loved to have had, but we are very happy with who we do have. And I, you know, there's the worlds that were involved in the campaign. There's like 60 authors, novelists and game designers and screenwriters. But when we launch to the public in hopefully November-ish, anyone will be able to create a world in Storium, which is kind of like a reusable storytelling playset for a given genre or style or setting.
Very cool. So any of those authors that were involved in that anthology could go out there and just do that.
That would be awesome, and they'd love to, absolutely.
Cool, and then that could generate interest again, and then people can start knocking on her door and bothering her for a sequel. Understood.
You and I are going to have a talk.
You got to look out for your friends.
Yeah, exactly.
Hopefully. That's not what that is.
Mm-hmm. So Jame, how do you want to steer this thing? What do you want to do?
So I think I want to start off with having people talk about, you know, classic space opera and what some of their favorite works are. You know, there are some obvious ones like Star Trek versus Star Wars, and we could probably take the entire hour discussing the versus part of that. But, you know, there are so many wonderful founding works in science fiction that are space opera, and I would love to hear people talk about some of their favorites that maybe aren't household names and, you know, that are a little less known to some people. So I'll let you choose the order people talk in.
Okay, so let's start with Tansy.
Okay. Well, I'm trying to think that I don't know what the first space opera I really got into was, but in my early teens, Blake 7 was it as far as, the big UK one, which is, it was the gritty, dark criminals in space version of something like Doctor Who. And so spaceships, but also just people being really cranky with each other. so that was one of the big TV influences. And in books, Anne McCaffrey, a lot of her books, particularly ones like the Rowan series, which is all about, you know, space transportation of and using telepathy and telekinesis through space, but also very much about the people who had those jobs and what it was like. I've always been interested in the social side of the stories. Robotech was my big one.
Yeah.
One of my big influences to what you want out of a space opera, as in true melodrama, like the soap opera side, melodrama, romance, friendship, banter, but also big spaceships and alien battles and all that.
I'm still angry about Roy.
I'm actually doing a big rewatch at the moment and watching it for the first time with my 9-year-old. And she was she's watching the episodes through, and she looks and she goes, "Does the blonde one die, Mummy?" And I'm like, "Yes." And she's like, because it just seems really obvious that he's going to die. Spoilers, everybody.
And poor Claudia.
I know, but this thing, I loved that series, and it had that thing where it was accessible for very young, impressionable minds. But it also had a lot of kind of interesting adult ideas too, and I later read the novelizations, which I love. You know, they're proper science fiction. They've sort of packed them up as if this is this whole history, I loved that story so much. And all the little details I'm really noticing on this big rewatch of things like the technology they interact with. They have vending machines that chase you down the street saying, "Do you want a drink?" they have little, their security cameras have little legs, and you can kind of pull them out and talk to them and get them to snap a picture of you. I love all that interaction with technology and just the day-to-day social stuff and these really big ideas and big stories. So even though it is crazy melodrama and very silly, like there's this whole episode where there's a beauty pageant, everybody is watching it, including the people involved in the alien space fight.
Yes.
And flight control traffic control. They're all watching this other TV station. It's like, that is just not safe.
And they're obsessed with it. Procedure. Yes, they were. And, you know, I bought the comic books too. And back in the day, the comic books were essentially no better than screenshots of the TV show. I mean, it was just panel for panel what happened on the show.
But you needed that because this was in the days, you know, it was harder to get things like video and, mm-hmm. and DVD and you know, live streaming. You couldn't actually necessarily rewatch these things. That's why I collected the novelizations. I hoarded them and read them over and over. And yeah, so that was a big one for me. Yeah. And then later, probably one of the big ones, of course, is Les McMarsh de Bujold, the Miles Vorkosigan series, which, again, that combination of genuine people stories with how people interact with the dig technology and the battles and all the military stuff. I loved it. Loved that series to bits. Ate it up with a spoon.
Jason, what about you?
You know, I was actually thinking back to my first non-Star Wars type exposure, and there was this cheesy, horrible 80s movie, but it was classic space opera tropes called Ice Pirates.
Yes! Robert Urich!
Oh, yeah.
Yes!
Yes! I loved that stupid movie!
And it was so dumb. It took everything that they should never have done in Star Wars, and there's even references to aliens, but my little 7-year-old mind wrapped around that, yep. And... you know, I just got obsessed, and I think I've worn that out. I was flipping through something the other night, and I saw it on TV again. I made my kids watch it. They hated it. you know, but it was just a classic space opera. It was just, and probably the worst example out there. It's everything wrong with that aspect of the genre. As far as books, I felt Star Wars caught me because it has such a huge backstory in Otherworld. So I was looking for that, and I stumbled across Niven's Known Universe series, you know, and everything from the Ring World and everything else. And while it wasn't fast-paced, you know, like you get in a lot of space opera, it felt that immense, huge universe with this huge backstory, and the whole thing was focusing on characters. And he threw in, you know, fantastical elements, you know, people who are genetically modified so that they're more lucky than others, and you know the different races and stuff that seemed very Star Wars like. And I think I have burned through every single Known Universe book I can find, just because I just loved, you know, the detail that he put into those.
Very cool. Now, what about you, Daniel?
Well, when it comes to the kind of first impression, my first run across it, you know, that was Star Wars, same as, you know, everybody my age.
Now everybody, but people do say that, a lot of people say that Star Wars was space fantasy, not space opera.
I think that's splitting hairs.
Okay.
I'm not impressed by that difference, because it's, you know, if you don't mean Flash Gordon when you say space opera, I don't know what you're talking about. Because Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers and Star Wars and Star Trek, what we're talking about at that point is various levels of, I guess, scientific plausibility, which seems to miss the point to me. Because those are the ones that I took with me. As far as books go, ditto on Niven, and also Alfred Bester was fairly important for me. With The Demolished Man and The Star is My Destination. And Harry Harrison with the Stainless Steel Rat books. And, you know, I think that moving, you know, more recently, I didn't bond with Robotech because I didn't have a television at that point in my life, so there was no way to watch it. And by the time I did have a television, what we were watching was Cowboy Bebop. So that was the one that I wound up coming to later on.
And a lot of people did.
Yeah, and because it's great, right? And that keeps coming up in conversations like years and decades later. It's not something that I think people recognize as a classic in the field, but it just has this amazing staying power.
As does Robotech, but it's just like Star Wars versus Star Trek. You have people who like one or the other a lot of times.
Having seen what little of Robotech I've seen, I'm perfectly willing to like them both.
Well, and Robotech actually continued on past the show. They did the second one, the third one, but they also did Robotech 2, the Sentinels in comics. They did a halfway decent connection movie between the first and the third series. It was like a 3D computer graphic thing called Shadow something or other. That was pretty good.
There's also something to be said for kind of more recent media with like Mass Effect and Halo.
Mm-hmm.
When you come to like absolute number of hours spent, probably Mass Effect at this point is running pretty close to even with like Larry Niven for me.
Yeah, at my last job, I was the marketing director. I had a marketing assistant who knew nothing about anything science fiction-y. And I told her as part of her job, she had to tell me who the Master Chief was. And she couldn't do it.
It's
sad. So, but luckily I left there before I had to, you know, get rid of her for that. But Steven.
Yes.
What do you think? What was some of your first impressions?
Well, my very first impression was almost certainly Star Wars. You know, before I was even able to read, probably I watched that and had a very deep impact on me from a very young age. And once I was reading, I'd say it was Ringworld. You know, the Niven novels, Arthur C. Clarke, Rendezvous with Rama, all those sorts of books just really captured my imagination as a kid. I don't know if Dune is really space opera or not, but love the hell out of that world as well.
I think that's space opera. I'd give it that.
Space opera.
I could. I'm glad to hear that. I mean, I think it's a pretty big tent personally. So I'm going to say it's space opera too. So I love Dune. I love every adaptation that's been done of it in different ways.
Every adaptation?
Every. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. They're all bizarre in different ways.
Tell me about the waters of your home world, Ursul.
Indeed. So that was kind of where it started. I mean, I watched Robotech too. Big fan of Robotech growing up. I still think that is something that is prime for to be returned to in a live action way.
There's a Kickstarter right now for
it. Yes, there is, and I have backed that. So that's good stuff. I mean, more recently, I would say, you know, on the book side, I've been really enjoying Ian Banks' Culture series quite a bit, and I'm very saddened with his passing recently. And, you know, Daniel doesn't need any ego prop up from me, but I love The Expanse. I just finished Siebel of Burn just a few nights ago, so congratulations.
Why,
well
you.
Done.
That's very kind of you.
Totally great stuff.
I hear it's going to be a TV show, maybe.
Sounds like it, doesn't
it? I'm literally in the room where we're building it right now.
Oh, turn on the camera, man. Come on.
I would be killed. There are ninjas. I would be killed.
Yeah, can you do me a favor, though, Daniel? Can you sneak across the hall and find out what's going on with Blackbirds?
Oh.
No, they don't tell me anything. I'm in a black box. I'm completely cut off.
All right, Steven, anything else?
Well, I mean, I'll say that kind of right now, until the Expanse series comes out, of course, I'd say my favorite TV sci-fi is probably Farscape. Yeah, and so I don't know if I should go into Farscape mode yet or if I should wait until later in the conversation.
I love Farscape.
But that's, yeah.
We will touch on Farscape.
And Derek, I have given you 23 minutes to come up with something since I kind of messed you up on giving you the completely wrong description here. What was your first experiences with space opera?
Well, thanks for all the extra time. I'm gonna split this up into, you know, the classics space opera and what is more modern now, because I mean there's people doing fantastic space opera now that has nothing to do with the sort of insulting term that space opera was back then, like when you could land on, you know, the surface of Neptune and refuel your ship and take off. So, I mean, I grew up in small town Canada and, you know, we got TV with an aerial and stuff like that. So, I mean, my first exposure to the classic sort of space opera was, you know, Saturday morning cartoons. So they had like, you know, Space Academy and Jason of Star Command. They had Flash Gordon on in the morning, and then Tuesday nights before Sheriff Lobo, I could see Buck Rogers. And then after school, there was like the Star Blazers and stuff. And then when I was
Star Blazers,
I loved Star Blazers. Eh?
Captain Harlock.
Never saw that. Sorry, but I lived with an aerial. So
okay.
Yeah, and but then you know I saw Star Wars, and that was, you know, the rite of passage as it is for everybody. And then when I was at Then though, the whole medium switched for me, and I became a comic book reader. And I was exposed to space opera through, you know, Jim Starlin's Adam Warlock, and through Marvel's Captain Marvel, and, you know, some of the Guardians of the Galaxy stuff there.
How about Green Lantern?
I didn't read DC. I didn't respect DC when I was a kid.
Yeah, that's been my theory all along, is that kids like Marvel, and as you grow up and become teenagers, you start reading DC.
I didn't switch to DC till I was an adult, and yeah, I'm still not sure I'm there. But anyway, it might be I'm too loyal to Marvel. But I got into novels via comic books because I was reading a John Carter of Mars comic, and it, you know how they have those little asterisks that say, you know, by the way, you have to go back to this previous comic to get this story. And one of those times they were saying, you have to go back to Princess of Mars. And I'm like, what's going on? So I picked up one of those books, and then I started consuming everything that Edgar Rice Burroughs had written, and eventually graduated to the Robot series, the Foundation series, Ringworld, Dune, and all that. And even some Stephen Baxter, although that didn't come till later. So, I mean, mine has been much more, you know, the classic kind, and then I got into the modern kind of space opera just in the last decade.
Would everybody consider Space 1999 to be a space opera?
I would, yeah.
Totally. Yes.
Yeah, I was surprised no one mentioned that. What about, and I was also surprised no one mentioned, like, Forbidden Planet.
I didn't come to Forbidden Planet until I was pretty old, and at that point it felt like the Star Trek beta release.
Well, I think Star Trek had, I think it influenced Gene Roddenberry, the Great Bird, quite a bit. And you can tell that just by looking at it. And plus, I like it because I think it's the only movie Leslie Nielsen ever made straight.
He did a fine job. It's a little weird to go in reverse and see him being the Captain Kirk character. You keep expecting him to mug for the camera.
He never really does. Not really. Okay, James, what's next?
So... Farscape, since that was brought up.
Yes!
I know that there are a couple of people here who might have a little bit to say about that, but one of the things I love about Farscape is that
it's coming back. Like,
well, that too. Well, I'm very, very leery of that. I really, really hope that it is wonderful, and I'm not sure that I trust that it will match the original. But one of the things that I really like about it is that while it is, in many ways, you know, the child of an era of Star Trek and Star Wars, it has a lot of the call-outs to the tropes of the early science fiction and space opera. Totally. It also has many elements of social science fiction, and I really love that. I love how smart it is while still maintaining a certain amount of excitement and fun. And so what I want to ask is, you know, what is it about the space opera genre that lends itself to possibly making some gentler points of humanity and, you know, how we should be preparing for if we do actually meet other races and how to deal with them? What are the lessons we can take from space opera?
And go Daniel.
I think the thing that's really in the bones of space opera is that it, however dark or gritty or weird you go with it, it is at heart an optimistic genre, because we've gotten out there and there is this frontier and there's this sense of discovery and possibility that when you shut that out, things wind up getting grim and bleak pretty quickly. So in the DNA of the genre, there's that sense of hope. And I think that's kind of indispensable, especially these days. I mean, it's an old trope that any time you write science fiction, you're actually writing about the age that you're in, about the time that you're writing in. And for my money, the idea that there is a future and that there is something to aspire to as far as discovery and learning new stuff, that's valuable all in itself. Beyond that, it's also really cool because it's a story universe that accepts all of the other genres and stories into it. I mean, you can tell a murder mystery in a space opera. You can tell a Western in a space opera. You can tell a romance in a space opera. It accepts all of those. And so it winds up being very broad in a way that I think some other genres aren't.
Interesting. Derek?
Yeah, so I'm going to be the heretic here and say that I never actually watched Farscape. I'd love to say they stopped it at the border, but I don't think that's the reason. But I'd like to maybe take the opposite view of Daniel, because I do think that classic space opera is optimistic, but in the modern stuff, I don't see it as optimistic, and some people say that that's one of the sort of defining tonal differences between the more modern, let's say, UK-based stuff. And I agree that, you know, you can have a murder mystery. And I just finished reading Chasm City by Alistair Reynolds. And I mean, the amount of noir darkness in that, you know, yes, the heroes seem to come to some sort of good ending. But I mean, the amount of filth and darkness they go through, I find it hard to see where space opera necessarily lends itself to the gentler humanity. So I don't know. I'll throw that out then as, you know, a point of discussion.
Tansy?
Yeah, I did watch Farscape and loved it greatly.
Did you have any problems with the accents?
No, funnily enough. And in fact, as an Australian, Farscape is brilliant for us because almost every episode would be, oh, that's so-and-so from, you know, our local soaps or our local... It wasn't just like some of the main characters, but so many characters on there were people we knew from other shows. So it is an honorary Australian.
The only painful thing to come out of that actually is Claudia Black's American accent that she tries to do.
Yes.
Yeah. Claudia Black's Australian accent is a very good accent.
Yes.
That's all I can say about that.
But her American accent, not so good. Anyway, go ahead.
What I loved about Farscape is how funny it was. Like, yes, it had the dark, it had the angst, it had the big action-packed stories, but that sense of humor is generally what isolates, for me, the space opera that I'm going to enjoy and the space opera that I'm not going to enjoy. I agree with Derek. I think it's getting a lot darker, as science fiction is generally losing a lot of optimism. But that's a tonal thing that shifts, and hopefully it'll shift back because, you know, I've always loved the stuff where you might have the dark, angry, epic stories, but you've still got somebody's bringing the snark to keep the chin up, which is, I think, true of any story where terrible things are happening. Farscape was brilliant because you had characters who were laughing in the face of adversity and, you know, they were teasing each other even as they were saving each other's lives and stuff was blowing up and horribleness was happening. An equivalent space opera that I love at the moment, which I think is some of the best space opera currently being written and is very optimistic as well as being bleak, is Saga, which is the Brian Vaughan and Fiona Staples comic, which is just amazing. And it is a very human story. It's a story about love and family and war and all these big dramatic storylines. But it's also so funny, and it's its funniest when it's also being really horrible. You know, they have hilarious death scenes that are also like really quite cringe-making. It's very violent, but it also has this sense that people are important and individual people's stories are just as important as the giant picture. And I think it's particularly interesting because the characters are not in any way, like none of them are defined as human. A lot of even something like Farscape, which had the whole cast were, you know, aliens, except we had the everyman American human who had been put into the story to be the voice of the viewers. And Saga doesn't have that. And yes, it still is very much a story about humanity and trying to find the things, I don't know, worth fighting for. I love the fact that it's a story about parenting in the middle of a massive interstellar war, because that's a story that I don't see nearly enough in space opera. You know, the actual how do you cope with raising the next generation, because that's sort of one of those things that people have to do. So, yeah, I think they both work very well against each other. And,
Well, and I'll agree with you on the humor, because that the humor has to be there for me. And that's one of the reasons what I loved the Russell T. Davies run on Doctor Who, mm-hmm. because of the humor that was in there that was interjected quite often. And I've often said to friends offline that I don't think it would have been quite as successful if that humor hadn't been there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's quite a... No, it's something that I'm familiar with because as an Australian, we have had a massive cultural influence from Britain, and there is something about British science fiction that can be quite bleak but also very funny. I mentioned Blake 7 earlier, which is, you know, on the, it which is kind of like if they did Firefly but in the 70s. And yeah, very dark, horribleness happens. I mean, it's just badness all the time. The characters are constantly on the run, miserable, being shot at. They're never going to catch a break. But the sense of humour is what makes the show memorable. It's what makes it still watchable now, even though it was made in 1978. And some of it is unintentionally hilarious, and there are giant mutant snails. However, that it's the witty dialogue. It's people keeping their chin up and actually riffing off each other in the face of the big... So it makes it... I know it's what makes stories like that last. I think it's really interesting that so many people, the space opera that they love is not just decades, but sometimes, you know, up to 40 or 50 or longer years old. We're talking about serious old books, and yet there's something about them that survives that makes people want to keep rereading them.
Exactly.
And I think that it's the characters that do it. But that's just.
We'll see if Jason agrees with you.
Well, I do, because I think that, you know, going back, I think that a lot of science fiction has started to turn dark here, and I think that's actually why things like Farscape and Saga have blipped on the radar, is because these things are so much brighter, they're so much energetic, they just seem to be very attractive to the mainstream because they have that sense of wonder. Some of the questions and some of the circles that I've been talking, you know, the space industry, is that so many of these people got into space because, you know, the early science fiction was so optimistic and so much about the wonder. And the question is, now we're seeing less and less of that because, you know, so much of this science fiction is not as optimistic. And so I think that's one of the reasons I like Farscape. I got a catch last night, that 17-minute preview for Guardians of the Galaxy, and it seems like it's hitting all of those things that, you know, we listed that we loved about Farscape. You've got witty humor, you've got great characters, you've got fun energy, you've just got these incredibly, you know, wonderful bright characters against this, you know, huge space thing, you know, space expanse, and it's also at the same time very accessible for the mainstream viewer. You know, which is, I think, one of the benefits of Farscape. You know, my wife hates science fiction, and, you know, the one thing I was able to, I said, hey, you know what, this is Jim Henson. You like the Muppets? You're going to like this.
Well, now, other people, though, that's what turned them off. I've had the people who say that they did not watch Farscape, did not like it, say that they didn't like it because it was Muppets in space.
Well, it wasn't Miss Piggy, and it wasn't Kermit. But, yeah, you know, it did have a little bit of a Muppets in space, but... You know,
that was so good.
That was what was cool about it, you know. And I mean, actually digging further into that one, the thing that I loved about it is because they played around with that, I think they were able to do things that even Star Trek wasn't able to. They were able to dig into the weirdness of what life is going to be out there. I mean, the scientists tell us that, you know, once we get out there, the biology of life is not going to be an analog to what we find here on Earth. And that was the beauty of Farscape, is the aliens came in all different shapes and sizes. I mean, you have organic ships and, you know, I mean, that just is just that idea of some people when they're watching that are like, wow, I've never even thought of anything like that.
Well, unless you watched Babylon 5.
Yeah. I struggle with Babylon 5. You know, I'm a detractor of that one.
I accidentally disconnected Jason. Sorry, guys.
Oh, can you hear
me? It's okay. I have my defense of Babylon 5 when you guys are ready for it. It's ready. It's all okay. Written
Jason,
out.
Before you feel too ganged up on, I'm with you. So,
I mean, I'm a lover of Straczynski's work, and I love his comic book work. His run on Spider-Man I thought was absolutely brilliant. I'm a collector of everything else he's done. I have tried over and over to get into Babylon 5, and I don't know, maybe it's the... It's the hokey Amiga video toaster graphics. I don't know what it is, but, you know, I'll leave it there.
I can help you with that. I can tell you how to get into Babylon 5.
Okay, what would be the entry point?
The entry, you have to watch the first season in 1 week, and you have to be drunk. Just get through it. It is one of the most punishing seasons of television ever made. And you can't actually even skip it because it's doing a lot of groundwork for later seasons. I hold up Babylon 5 as my example of one of the ugliest successes in television. I think it's hard to watch. It's cheesy. It's often unconvincing, and structurally it is so solid that when you get to the end of it, despite all of that, the ending sticks.
Totally.
Okay. It has such a fascinating place in television, though, because by the end of the series, by the end of that 5 years, it was no longer a weird idea to have genre TV where the episodes had to be watched in a particular order.
Right.
No, because even Star Trek changed during the same era.
Yes, Deep Space Nine started doing that.
Deep Space Nine came in, and also Next Gen changed as well, because it used to be, you know, the show was pretty much designed so, you know, if a few episodes were swapped out, it wouldn't matter. Very few, even things like season finales and stuff weren't necessarily something that you expected. And by the end of Babylon 5, people were looking at science fiction differently and genre shows, other genre shows at the same time.
And television. I would maintain that you wouldn't wind up with Buffy or Veronica Mars or Damages. Any of those really long arc shows wouldn't have made it if they hadn't had something like Babylon 5 that blazed the trail.
And you kind of have to do the same thing with the first season of Buffy. You have to watch it really fast. And when you come to the demon that infects the computer and builds a robot, you just have to push through. Just push through. Push through. It gets better.
I you know, any point where you have to say things like, just go for it. It gets better. I start worrying. Fortunately, I watched, I think, the sixth season of Buffy before I watched that, because I went back and I watched that. I was like, even in the 90s, I don't think I would have really accepted this is what's going to happen. Although it does sound a lot like some of the ideas my grandmother had about the computers and demons and stuff.
So, Stephen, you get the last word on this part.
Right. Well, I mean, going back to James' question about why sci-fi and space opera in specific are good vehicles for social issues, you know, again, not as a writer, but as part of the audience, as a consumer, a reader, I feel like space opera is this beautiful template for sort of distracting you from any variety of issues that you as the author might want to express. Like distracting you so that the issues get through, right? Because it basically, like, take Battlestar Galactica, for example, right? Like the new reimagined series. I would suggest that it is not really a show about spaceships and cyborgs and so forth and explosions. It is a show about the collapse of society, right? And like what we return to and what we are fundamentally and how we treat each other and what would happen in these sort of scenarios. And so it is really a stage that's been set very nicely to give you a way to explore those issues without having to set it in our world with all these sort of prejudices and biases that would bring with it. So that to me has always been interesting in much of the sci-fi I've read, obviously, and I think it applies to a lot of space opera as well. Not always. I'm not sure Star Wars has some deeper social message, frankly, but I still love it.
I believe the deeper message inside of Star Wars has to do with midichlorians.
Right. Yeah. Eat your midichlorians, kids. In terms of Farscape, I would just say that I just think it's a wildly creative and playful show. And part of why I think it's so special is that it feels like it's from an adjacent universe. Like somebody activated a skip drive and brought it over like from the universe next door, and all the physical constants are slightly off. And as a result, like, it looks familiar, right? It looks like you can see John Carter and Buck Rogers and, you know, Blake Seven, frankly, and a bunch of stuff in there. when you look at it.
We just decided that Australia was from an alternate universe because this is kind of awesome.
That's what I got out of it.
I mean, I knew you were from the future, Tansy, but this is amazing.
Yeah, well, you're giving away all our secrets at this point.
That explains why everything on your continent is trying to kill you too. So,
yep.
Yeah, I mean, like, and I'm sure that's part of it too, right? Is that all the actors are, are Australian or Kiwis? But you know, it's something deeper than that. I think is that it just sort of turns a lot of those tropes on their head slightly, and it does it with a very playful tone. And as a result, like, I'd much rather watch Farscape than Battlestar Galactica. And it's not because I think that, you know, one is like, you know, hugely better than the other. I think they're both excellent shows. But this goes back to Daniel's earlier point and something that's also been discussed after, which is sort of the darkness versus the light. You know, I think that those are two great examples of the two sides of the coin of space opera. You know, Battlestar Galactica, the reimagined series, is wonderful, but it is a slog to watch, you know? It is an emotional journey. That I actually don't look forward to doing very often, despite how wonderfully executed it is. Whereas Farscape is much more playful. And as I look at the sci-fi that I enjoy, you know, I actually find that I go back and forth. I have kind of a mix of the two in my own interests.
Well, now I have a question for all of you, because we've kind of postulated the idea that Babylon 5 started something that continued on, which was, you know, the long story arcs and everything is connected, and you can see the patterns, you know, Babylon 5 into Star Trek and Deep Space Nine and Voyager, and they had these connected things. Then you can go into other shows like Lost and different science fiction things, Doctor Who, the reboot of Doctor Who, Battlestar Galactica. Did it kind of create a bubble that then burst? Because now it seems like Hollywood wants to kind of go pull back on that and not do that anymore, and they just want the monster of the week kind of stuff.
That has not been my experience.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm sitting here building one of these things that is intended to be long arc stories where it builds on that, and so I'd have to say the genre's not dead.
Okay.
From the outside, the way that American television works seems a little bit alien to me, but I get the impression that there is a big divide between the shows that are on like network TV that people see every week and yes. that and the stuff that's on the cable channels, which is much more aimed at, I guess, the box set audience from yes, a DVD absolutely. Point of view or whatever, or the Netflix sort of model now as well, where
the binge
people
watchers.
Are producing television that works like a novel, and every episode of the thing, and they're expecting everybody to just buy the whole thing or watch the whole thing at once. Whereas there's also the disposable stuff, and it seems to me like a lot of the more interesting genre stuff is happening in the box set world less than the sort of more disposable television end, but of course that's also where the money is, so I don't know. The whole television model is being changed up.
Yes.
But I think that big box set kind of science fiction, I mean, things like Battlestar Galactica and that sort of thing really benefited from that idea. It's like Game of Thrones now. I mean, Game of Thrones is sort of the other side of the coin. Epic fantasy is the same genre effectively as space opera. It's just the fantasy equivalent.
If we had
a science fiction version of Game of Thrones, I think it would have, which would be awesome.
And part of what you're talking about, though, Tansy, part of what you're talking about, what I think is that network television in America is less willing to take that risk, and so those types of shows are moving to cable.
Yeah, well, that's what I get the impression of. And things like Firefly, I mean, that sort of showed what happens when you try and tell one of those cohesive all-in-one stories and you try and do it through the network television lens and they don't trust you and it all falls to hell.
And they make you change it up and they say, no, don't do that episode, do this episode because it got more action and don't do it in the order you intended. You need support
because space opera, I mean, needs, I think, I mean, it can work as an episodic thing, but I feel that to tell a space opera properly, you do need a level of consistency. You need to be able to tell a big story, and you need to be able to know you can tell that story over several seasons or over a big canvas. And it's not something you can carve up. Sorry.
There's also the issue that a lot of network shows are 22 episodes.
Yes.
And that's a lot of work to make. When you have something on HBO or Netflix, can be any length you want it to. HBO, I think they're like 10 and 12 hour seasons.
Which is very similar to what you get out of the UK.
Which makes it possible to produce a genre show like Game of Thrones that has a lot of production going into it and a lot of work. If you're doing 22 hours a year, it needs to be something that's not that intensive and not that removed from the sets that you can build easily or find the way that a lot of genre stuff is. So I think that I think when you get into basic cable, the pay channels and all of the new markets that are coming up, you know, if you go to Xbox and Powers over on PlayStation, on Sony, it's a much more forgiving place for the kinds of shows that we're talking about.
Interesting. Jason, any thoughts?
Well, you know, one of the things I just keep thinking about is when I'm having Daniel actually here is I'm one of the guys over here that's kind of geeking out a little because I'm a fan of the Expanse series. and I was one of the ones very delighted when I heard that Sci-Fi had picked it up. And I remember that I saw multiple blogs where the title was Space Opera Returns to Television. You know, and that was actually the way that the news was carried, I think, that entire week when they broke the, you know, the publication of it. And I think that kind of, though, communicates a little bit that there really was. Battlestar Galactica ended, and I know there's other stuff going on, but I think everybody saw that as really one of the high points of sci-fi on television. And yes, there's Game of Thrones, but it is fantasy, and it isn't science fiction, and it doesn't scratch that itch. And people want something like Battlestar Galactica where they can just fall in and they can immerse and they can let their minds run. And so we kind of went through this gap here the last few years. I think people are geeked to see, okay, because this isn't the only one that sci-fi's, ordered. There's this other one. There's an Interstellar one.
And they've got Space Eureka.
Space Eureka?
Yeah, Defiance.
Oh, that's
where the lawman and his daughter come to the town and they become the law people there, and she's a misfit who can't get along with everybody and is a troublemaker, and he's trying to be the law guy. It's Space Eureka.
It really is Space Eureka, and it was horrible. It was, you know, see, that's the reason people are excited about, you know, Expanse coming, because, you know, let me take this back. How about good space opera is returning to television?
Well, do we consider Falling Skies to be space opera?
To be honest, this is just my perspective. I think it's more along the line of some of the dystopian novels that we see out there. I would feel that Falling Skies is more in the vein of Walking Dead with laser guns.
Skitters.
You know.
Okay. Steven?
Yeah, I'm super geeked as well for The Expanse. And, I was very sad when Battlestar Galactica went off the air. Fortunately, there's plenty of great books to read in this genre.
And to be honest with you, I mean, at least they gave you that wonderful 2-hour movie called The Plan.
Yeah, that was, I mean, I like everything about the Battlestar Galactica universe. I didn't really watch the that prequel series. Spacing that on the name now.
Blood and Chrome?
No, the other one.
Caprica.
Thank you. Yeah. I didn't actually get to see Caprica, unfortunately, but I enjoyed pretty much everything else they did. It's obviously a genre that I love, and I'm excited to see The Expanse come back. I'm just psyched that, like, Daniel and Ty are so involved in it, as I've been hearing. That seems like a really good sign.
It's been a blast. It really, I don't know how it's going to all play out from here because it's my first time around the block, but it's really pretty being here.
Daniel, has Ty been able to make any headway on that introduction to Jamie Murray?
I can neither confirm nor deny literally anything.
Okay. So, Jane, we're running out of time. What else?
So one of the things I really wanted to bring up, I don't know if anyone else on the podcast has seen a comic called Starstruck. It was done. I came into it because my friend Lee Moyer did the coloring for it, and it's beautiful and weird, and the collective work is gigantic. It has Elaine Lee and Mike Kaluta on it. But it kind of was when I started thinking about how good space opera is visually, how it's probably one of the best introductory tools for science fiction and fantasy, even in many ways, because it is so visual and there's so much space for people to get excited about things, no pun intended. And so what I wanted to ask is, you know, is there something about a space opera that makes it possibly better as a TV show or even a game, you know, whether that game is something like Storium where it's written, or say the Firefly board game, but gives it that advantage over other things and therefore makes it a really good introductory tool for people maybe who don't really think that science fiction and fantasy is their thing.
By the way, that Firefly board game is ridiculously difficult to figure out.
It is?
Yeah. I had a hard time with it. So let's start with Jason.
You know, I think that space opera is an entry point. I think it's, I mean, I'll go straight to video games. Someone had said Mass Effect earlier, and I'm a huge fan of that. I'm a huge fan of the Halo series. And I think kids who won't read, kids, you know, and I'm just thinking of even my own kids who, you know, try and put, you know, a massive space opera thing in front of them. And if it's not Percy Jackson or a, something they're not going to get into it, but you know, Halo grabs them and it pulls them in. And I think part of space opera is it is a very visual thing. It's huge graphics. It's huge images. It's you know, I was reading an article that 3D works really well for space movies because you can actually pull the distances out even further and the sense of 3D is even larger. And I think that's just, you know, indicative of the entire thing. You know, we imagine the spaceships rolling through. We imagine the laser battles. We imagine the destruction and the, you know, the strange blue creatures. And I think that does lend itself to saying, okay, this can easily work in a more visual medium and it can very well work for people who don't want to pick up a book, who don't want that to be their entry point. But, you know, for like a lot of us, it can easily become that doorway. You know, I think someone mentioned earlier the Edgar Rice Burroughs series, that it was the visual medium of comics that ended up getting them into books. But yeah, I think space opera, and the reason Star Wars works so well is it fits very, very well with bright colors and, you know, big images.
Interesting. And what did you think of the revelation that Saren Arterius and the Master Chief were actually the children of the character from the old Nintendo game? You remember the game with the... oh, never mind.
Do you mean a Metroid?
Or? Yes, Metroid. I figured you'd jump in.
I've heard that theory. No. No, that's a horrible, but you know, yeah, you know, it's, you know, it's, the thing cool even about Halo is, you know, you look at what can people cosplay real well, you know, and space opera seems to be a whole lot easier. You know, you don't see anybody, trying to, you know, I don't know, cosplay some of the, hard science fiction elements out there.
Yeah. Derek.
Yeah, I agree that science fiction is very, very visual, and I think that's because of the whole sense of wonder history to it and still is at its core. I mean, I'm rereading Ringworld right now, and I mean, even not on the screen, even not in a comic book, when he just goes on about what it's like to lose infinity in your horizon when you're dealing with you know, a structure that's, you know, 2 AU across. It's just amazing. Like, and some of the structures, he's like talking about the biggest mountain in, you know, the galaxy or something. And, you know, just knowing that, you know, for example, the biggest mountain in the solar system is on Mars, and just trying to get your head around that. And I think those sorts of things are the sorts of things that, you know, respond to the golden age of science fiction, which is 8 years old to 12 years old. I mean, that's when you're stunned about, you know, who's faster, Flash or Superman, and, you know, oh, which is the biggest mountain. And so the whole thing about, I remember when I was a kid and just the sort of visuals of, you know, an asteroid floating in a background of stars or floating junk, it's such a sense of wonder rush that, totally visual and totally brings in the people with the magic of what they're seeing and the magic of what can be invented.
Very cool. Tansy?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, space opera for me, it's often all about the frogs, frankly. and, you know, the amazing costumes and aliens, the kinds of color. I think a lot of people have mentioned color. We get that a lot. You know, there's, I think, because Star Wars and things like Flash Gordon have brought in this crazy wild design palette that really associates hard. I think that's why Battlestar Galactica, a lot of people didn't quite know how to frame it as space opera, simply because, you know, it was all very gritty and they're wearing fatigues and no one was wearing ball gowns in space, which I think in retrospect was a design failure. I think that color and the clashes, the cultural world building that happens through the visuals, I think, and as many people have said, you know, the comics, I mean, it's one of the great things about Saga is how it looks and the kind of whole stories you get from a single panel and the way the different alien designs interact with each other. Extraordinary stuff. Having said all that, I will argue against it because there's quite a bit of space opera I really enjoy that is audio only. I mean, probably the first one that really hit me as far as how space opera or science fiction works really, really well as a radio story, I actually first came to Asimov as a series of radio plays, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is one of the craziest. Yes, it's a comedy, but it is also space opera, very much so. It's all planets and aliens and crazy things happening in space. And Hitchhiker's Guide is, it looks good on screen, but it's so good on audio only. It's these whole magic vistas are simply conjured up through words and through dialogue. Big Finish are a company who do brilliant Doctor Who plays on audio only. They've been going for 15 years now, and they've actually done quite a few original series as well. They've got one called Vienna, which is about a space assassin, starring Chase Masterton, who used to be on DS9.
Space Nine.
Yeah, she plays Vienna, who is a space assassin who uses memory box technology to actually change her whole memories for her doing her various missions, because that's how you get past all the telepaths. Extraordinary, brilliant, big vista space opera, and it's done in hour-long audio plays. So I think sound is one of those things that is just as important in some ways to the representation and may also contribute to why space opera works so well in film, because when we think of Star Wars, we're not just thinking about the lightsabers and the cute frocks that Amidala wears and all that sort of thing. We are also, like, the soundscape of Star Wars is probably the thing that kicks me in the nostalgia harder than anything else. I remember sitting there to watch Phantom Menace, which was, you know, let's not get into that. But the feeling of sitting in a cinema and a Star Wars movie starting, the first thing that hits you is the music.
Yep.
You know, and the sound effects. I mean, you can hear sound effects from Star Trek or Star Wars, and they will often get you before anything else as a recognizable kick to the guts. And so sound effects and the music, I think, are also big parts of that operatic side of space opera.
Now, Big Finish, didn't they kept Paul McGann around, didn't they? As the
yeah,
doctor?
They actually, they brought him back as a, and they did so, they've done so many stories with him, and they did it before the show came back.
Yeah,
so
they did.
He was the current doctor. And he still does. They've done some fantastic stuff with him.
They did a version of Shada, if I remember correctly.
They did that as well. That was one of their standalones. Yeah, based on the idea that they never actually got to Shada, and so he had to go back and redo it with an older Romana who was now president of Gallifrey, and they went back and had that adventure. Wonderful, yeah.
And they turned that into a
Flash series.
I love
listening to science fiction, and it's cheaper for them to make the really good stuff.
Well, and they also, they turned it into a Flash animation series.
Yeah, I missed that, but that was one of the experiments. They did a few in the early days. They were trying to match it with the visuals. Mm-hmm. I think they ultimately realized that they actually didn't need the visuals, which is quite interesting. You know, yeah. So you can just listen to the story and it works fine. Mm. And it conjures up the big stories, the big it gives you special effects that the BBC could never have put on the screen.
They do a lot. They do really well with what they have. So
they do. And there's a lot of spin-off stuff, so it's not just like they've also brought back Blake Seven in recent years and got all the cast back.
And they're
Red doing Dwarf. A lot of different properties. And they do original stuff as well. But lots of science fiction.
Stephen.
Yeah, I mean I spend my time in the world of the written word, right? Working on story because it's a written medium that's sort of wrapped in a game. So I spent a lot of time actually thinking about styles of storytelling that will be engaging to people. Because part of what we're trying to do here is to, in a sense, trick people into writing, you know, to give them a way to unlock their sort of inherent storytelling ability, which I think everybody has. I mean, we've all been doing it for the last hour, essentially. And so part of what we're trying to do with Storium is to make writing more accessible for people, make storytelling something that they see as more of an activity that they themselves can do and can be a part of. And so I think Space Opera is great there. And we actually have, I think, at least five of the writers we have for our Kickstarter are doing Space Opera, like James Patrick Kelly, Tobias Bakel, Fran Wild, and others are doing a variety of space opera settings that will be part of the Storium toolkit. And I think it works really well because so many people know the tropes, right? It's something that is so central for so many people. Like even people who aren't really sci-fi fans wouldn't think of themselves that way. They know Star Wars, right? Or they know Star Trek or something. So I think it's a nice entry point for a lot of people. And it's also an inherently, it's a very imaginative medium, right? It lends itself towards crazy visuals or impressions, or whether those are actually on the screen or on a page. It's a very fantastical place for people to explore, and I think that draws them in. And so it's not an accident that when we set up our roster of writers for our Kickstarter that we definitely made sure there was plenty of space opera there, plus the fact that I wanted it personally.
And Daniel?
I think actually the real power that space opera has is that it's a low prestige genre. Even in written science fiction, you know, you have hard science fiction, which is kind of looked on as the real stuff, and then there's space opera. And if you think about the roots of it in stuff like Flash Gordon and even Star Wars, we were talking about Star Wars, whether it was really space opera or space fantasy, and space fantasy is often a kind of dismissive term, saying it's not very serious-minded. The beautiful thing about that is it allows you to embrace accessibility as a virtue. Mm. Instead of trying to be really sophisticated, and I can say this because I write this stuff, a lot of the time, sophistication requires a certain level of inaccessibility. And a certain kind of reaching for status. Once you've given that up, you get to tell the stories that people don't give awards to necessarily, but enjoy. I mean, Star Wars was never going to win the Oscar, but it was the most important movie that came out that year.
Gotcha. Okay, James, we need to start wrapping this up and letting these folks go. What do you got for our final thoughts here?
So the last thing that I want to ask, and it's been addressed a little bit as we've gone along, is how is space opera useful in creating a future civilization that, as we're starting once again to look at space, we're getting things like the 100-Year Starship Symposium, we're having private corporations looking at asteroid mining and privately funded space travel. It's starting to be, again, a part of what we're thinking about. And what is the role of a space opera in making that something accessible for people at large and getting it back in the public mind?
Derek?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I'm not sure if it's space opera itself, like with its attendant sort of criteria of, you know, the vastness, the ancient civilizations and so on. that might do that, or the sort of near future stuff, like the colonization of, you know, the asteroids and Mars and, you know, the clouds of Venus and so on. But the thing is, you know, the colonization of the asteroids is space opera in some sense. So I think anything that's close enough to what we're living to now that people can say, okay, yeah, I can see that happening in 60 years or 160 years, that gets us, you know, that sort of buy-in if you get people, you know, early enough and get them dreaming. Because, you know, once you become an adult, you tend to become less open to, you know, just cutting loose and saying, wouldn't it be wonderful if? And so it's a matter of maybe getting to people before they have that built in, so that, you know, once that outlet is, that once that entry point is there, it stays in you all the time. And I think that's one of the magic pieces of science fiction, whether you know, it's space opera or near future or whatever you want to call it. I think that creating that entry point for people that gives them that sense of wonder as they go through life is there.
And Jason?
You know, maybe a little bit in opposition of that, not much. I do think actually space opera itself has a special place for that. I was last year for our 100-year Starship, we ended up having one of the developers for Mass Effect come, and I was out there promoting it, and I posted it to Reddit. And one of the first comments came up with this guy who was actually working on his doctorate degree in astronomy. And his line was, it was going through the Mass Effect series and standing. He actually remembered the visual. Standing, I can't remember the name of the ship now, but standing on the deck and going through the star map. And he said, that's what prompted me to follow astronomy. He goes, I had no desire until then. I caught that. It got me excited, and it propelled him. And I think that visual medium that space opera is takes it away from sometimes a cerebral thing and actually puts the idea of scientific exploration. It returns that sense of passion to it. It returns that sense of excitement. You know, not to do the pitch, but, you know, one of the things we say at 100 Year Starship is that space isn't just for rocket scientists and billionaires. And I think so often people think they've got to fit into that. And I think that space opera just reinvigorates people. It's exciting. It's cool. And all of a sudden it makes space, which before, you know, if you do it in school, can sometimes be a very boring thing to study, trying to name all the planets and the moons and all these other features. And it can just make it something that's like, wow, that is a world that's still to be explored. And, you know, it is true. We've got, you know, SpaceX has made, you know, continued strides here in the last few weeks. You know, Planetary Resources has done crazy cool things with Kickstarter in last year. I mean, we've got all these startups. We're kind of living in a science fiction world right now where we're on the cusp of it is possible for anyone to get involved in space exploration. And it's kind of funny at these events, you know, Planetary Resources kicked off. They had Brent Spiner there. At our symposium, we had LeVar Burton. It's key individuals who are part of some of this big space opera that are there because people got into it because they got inspired through these things.
Now, Brent Spiner was okay on Star Trek, but really, he made his bones on Night Court. Daniel.
I think that the thing that space opera has to offer is to give you a taste of what technology might be able to do and look like. I mean, I have an iPhone, I think, because Captain Kirk had a communicator. When you set people's imaginations on a path, we have an actually really good track record as a species of following that up as best we can. And so when you say, well, you know, people live on Ceres, people live on Ganymede, people live on Eros. One of the things that's interesting in the history of I think science and technology is it's only really a break for the first time. Even if you don't know how somebody else did it, once you see that it can be done, it's a lot easier to get there again. And this is kind of the suggestion that, you know, maybe that could be done. It's no longer unthinkable that we would live on a space station or travel between stars or find something alive out there that wasn't part of our tree of life. And that sense is, I think, what we have to offer and what we can give to those young, impressionable minds now that will pay off in 20, 30, 40 years.
Or maybe it will find us.
Then we're
dun,
boned.
Dun, dun.
Yeah, if it gets here first, well, it's not a bad thing.
I'm Steven. With Steven.
I love all the comments that have been made. I would echo them and maybe with a slightly different angle on them, which is that, you know, much of space opera takes place in the future or something that may as well be the future, right? You know, obviously Star Wars is meant to be the past in theory, but essentially space opera is about the future. And so I think that's perhaps its most powerful tool is that it encourages us to think about the future, right? And all the things that that means. It means, you know, the technology that we might have and how it would change our lives, what it would be like for our sphere of existence to change, all those questions. Every time you read space opera or you watch any of the shows we've talked about or films, no matter who you are, it makes you think about the future. And theoretically, that's why we're all here, right, is to make the future happen. And so if it encourages people to think bigger or to question, you know, where their own lives are going or the lives of those around them, that seems like a good thing.
I just want my damn jetpack. Tansy.
Don't we all?
I think it's a romanticization of the future, and I think that's okay. In fact, it's more than okay. I think it's pretty awesome. I think often as science fiction fans, there's often this thread of cringe or embarrassment and this idea that people might think that we're silly for liking science fiction. And how I think everybody has like at least a seed of that, however deep down it is or however they've come to terms that, you know, there is this sense where if we like science fiction, the people who don't understand science fiction will think that it's silly. And so we come terribly earnest and it's all about the worthy, the award-winning, as I said earlier, the serious, the crunchy, the gritty. And all those things are good and can tell great stories. But I like, I think it's nice to have the romance as well, the silly and the sublime and the big, crazy, mythic stories. They hit people right in the chest, you know? And I think it's no surprise that people who think they don't like science fiction will still go to the movies to see a story like that because it's worth seeing on the big screen. It's where we get our romantics about science fiction and the future and technology. And it, because it is so, it has that heightened drama, because it has that almost fantasy aspect. And I don't mean fantasy like magic, but fantasy like, you know, the big adventure. Because it has that, it feels like you don't have to maybe take it quite so seriously. So you can be more playful and more inventive and more, just a little bit left of center. It's where the adventure is. And adventure is a very powerful thing, and it does inspire people to dig into things a bit deeper. So
and
I love space opera.
And here's a startling fact about space opera that I don't know if any of you have ever realized before, but the one thing that is overarching in all of the space operas that are out there is there are no bagels.
It's a shame. We need to fix that.
It's tragedy.
So let's go ahead and take this home. Tansy, why don't you tell folks again your websites and your social media and all that good stuff?
Okay, you can find me and my Musketeer Space project at tanzyrr.com or the Musketeer Space page on Patreon, which is my crowdfunding platform. I'm TansyRR on Twitter, and I can be found talking a lot on Galactic Suburbia and Verity. Verity is the Doctor Who podcast. Galactic Suburbia is the Women Talk About SF Publishing podcast.
And
well, they're both all female podcasts.
And does anyone on the panel tonight other than Tansy know the significance of Verity? Ooh.
Nope.
Verity.
Oh, that is not good.
You knew, didn't you?
I know.
Verity, yes. Lambert was the original producer of Doctor Who in the 60s. Yes. She was a female producer, which is very rare at the time in the BBC. And in fact, they made a docudrama last year about her. Awesome. Called an Adventure in Space and Time.
Yes, it was wonderful.
Yes. So that's our Doctor Who, all-female Doctor Who podcast.
Yep.
And I am going to be at LongCon this year, along with 9,000 other people. And you can find many of my books at the 12th Planet Press stall in the dealer's room, because Australian small presses are coming to London thanks Very to cool. 12th
awesome.
Planet Press.
Awesome. Yeah. Jason, same thing. Website, social media, all that good stuff.
Probably the first one I'll push everyone to is the 100 Year Starship website, 100yss.org. If you are interested in space, we'd love for you to just come out and hang out with us. We've got a symposium coming up in September. James actually going to be there. So we've got a bunch of other people. So it's a cool place to geek out about interstellar travel with scientists and authors and fellow space geeks for a week in Houston. For me, you can find me. I'm on Twitter at jdanielbot. And then that's my website as well, jdanielbot.com. And if you want to read anything, the Tales of Dreamside series is the series of children's books I've written.
Very cool. Daniel.
My website is www.danielabraham.com, kind of uninventive there. I can also be found on Twitter at Abraham Hanover. And I'm on Facebook actually less and less these days, so probably one of those two.
Okay. Steven. I'm sorry, were you done, Daniel? You said
probably. Yeah, it was a verbal tick. You
okay.
can ignore me.
Okay. Steven.
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter as STL Hood, STLHOOD. And you can find Storium at storium.com, STORIUM. And we've finished our Kickstarter campaign, but we're actually continuing our crowdfunding directly through the site. So right now we're in beta testing for Storium, which again is an online storytelling game. And it's $10 to is the lowest backer level, and that gets you instant access to the beta test, which has a lot of people playing, a lot of games, telling a lot of stories right now. And we're in a phase right now where we're looking for feedback, and we're building out the rest of the system to launch it to the public later this year.
Very cool. Derek?
Yeah, my website is just as creative as Daniel's. It's justmyname.com, derekkrunskun.com. I also blog every couple of weeks at blackgate.com, and the Twitter is derekkrunskun. So, I had a lot of fun.
Do you want to spell your last name, dude? Come on.
Sorry. It's K-U-N-S-K-E-N.
Very cool. Yeah, and Blackgate is still going as a website, but I guess the magazine is done?
Well, they put fiction on there. They've got enough fiction to go for quite a while. And then they also have bloggers on there. Like, they have a really good roster of bloggers. And so I've actually blogged there about the year's best science fiction and space opera and stuff too.
Very cool.
That reminds me that I owe John a post or two over there. Whoops.
And finally, James.
Really?
Don't make me destroy you.
So I'm just as inventive as everyone else. I can be found online at jamegates.com. Twitter is just at jamegates. There are benefits to having a very unusual first name. I pretty much am the only one you will find if you look up Jame Gates. I'm really excited. Currently, we just launched War Stories out to the backers, and that is military
Congrats.
Science fiction. Thank you. And we have some space opera type stuff in there as well. So that'll be coming to a general release in late September, early October. The backers have it now, but we'll be getting ready for general release. So I'm really excited about that. I will actually be presenting at 100 Year Starship Symposium, which is terrifying me and is making me do a lot of reading and talking about quantum entanglement.
Yes.
So, yeah.
The best jokes are the quantum entanglement jokes.
Yeah. So, and I'm also just starting up a game on Storium, which is post-apocalyptic America with dragons. So if people want to just look me up on there, they can see kind of how one of those games is running and stuff. So, yeah.
Awesome.
Very cool. And if you want to send Jame an email and address it to Mr. Gates, you can get on the same shit list I'm on. So there.
That's okay. I did that to someone else today, so I really don't have a soapbox to stand on right now. Not to mention as a high-level reporter, so.
Oh, no. Yeah, the thing I enjoy the most about Jame's life is that she prefers to live a drama-free life, and that's why, you know, she is the publicist for CIFWA and all that good stuff, so.
Yeah, don't get me started.
Well, thanks to everyone for coming on tonight. Thanks for Jame for wrangling everyone. This was an awesome conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for listening to the SF Signal podcast. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the link to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com, and you can also search SF Signal in iTunes to find the feed. If you enjoyed this podcast, help us boost the signal by telling your friends. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melts featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SFNF field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, new author spotlights, movie reviews, videos, science fiction, fantasy, and horror tidbits, free fiction roundups, and the new genre-related crowdfunding roundups. Click the RSS button in the sidebar to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
Magic Wooey.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
And scene.